number one, and by far this is the most important thing, is that I lost money in poker and I went through downswings. There's nothing that prepares you for that in life. You know, when you grow up, and if you grew up like I did, and you went to like a school where you're very competitive at academics, and you know, your life is like more or less up and to the right. But when you get involved in gambling and you have a big downswing, the emotional stress that can take on you, if you haven't done it before, everyone has to go through that. I don't care who you are, how good your emotions are. The first time you have a downswing, you are going to have feelings you've never felt before. And I had those. So by the time I was 21, I had had all sorts of downswings and upswings and downswings and upswings. And I had gone through that mentally. And so I felt like when I got to the real world, especially trading, I looked around a few times. I saw some kid that had better grades than me that went to a fancier school than me. I saw them going through their first downswing in their whole lives when they were starting their trading career. And I saw how they got really upset and really emotional. And I remember like how I trained myself over the years in poker to handle downswings. You know, the way I typically try to handle upswings and downswings is just trying to focus on the process. Like, is my process right? Am I running bad or am I playing bad? You know, too many people when they're losing money, they think they're making a strategic mistake. And too many people when they're winning money, think they're making no strategic mistakes. So yeah, as a poker player, you get trained to continually work on your game, work on your process, whether you're winning or losing.
You're listening to Risk of Ruin. I'm John Reeder. This is The Frontier, Part 2. In part one, we heard about edges that can come from vulnerable game states, or secret information, or even just exploiting marketing money. Well, now we're going to start with another classic way to get an edge, which is to just find the right opponent. The easiest way to think about this is in poker. Here's Barry Greenstein.
I think while I was still an undergraduate, we were short of players and, you know, didn't know how to get more players. Then I got this idea, I'll just advertise in the student newspaper. So I advertised, you know, poker game, call this number, and I didn't get much of a response. We still didn't have enough players. Maybe one or two people asked about it, probably didn't show up. And then I got this idea, and I don't think I anticipated the response I was going to get, but I was trying to make money. And I said, and I thought I was a pretty good poker player at the time. You know, I was the biggest winner in our game. So I put an ad in, poker lessons, and gave my number. And I got 10 responses, easily enough, obviously, to fill a poker game. And the people are calling and saying, who are you to be given poker lessons? I bet you I play better than you. And they were like, people were insulted because that's kind of the way poker is. Everyone thinks their strategy is better than the other person's strategy. Obviously, if you didn't, you'd have a different strategy. So what I got were many people to show up coming to prove that they were better poker players than I was. You know, I remember being asked on the phone and the guy said, well, if you're so good, what are you charging for poker lessons? And I said, nothing. He said, what do you mean nothing? I said, you come over and play me and you can keep whatever you beat me out of and I'll keep whatever I beat you out of. If I win, that's going to be the cost of your poker lesson. And I guess people took that as such an affront that they showed up to play me heads up and they didn't do that well. And we had a poker game. It worked out well. We got a lot of people we didn't know existed on the campus to join our poker game and help fill up the game.
We made a full episode about the Mayfair, which was the New York Games Club that inspired a number of scenes in Rounders. Eric Seidel played there, and he said that one of the other players in the game was one of these dream opponents.
Yeah, Phil the Rabbi was a guy who, I think he was a factor in New York, and he would come into the Mayfair, and he would play, and he was a really wild player, and he really made the game good. It wasn't, and what's good about somebody like Phil the Rabbi is it's not just that he's playing badly, so he's going to lose a certain amount of money that hopefully you can win some of, but it also creates a much better game. Now it's an action game, and there's just it creates a lot more volatility, so that's very good for the better players. But he was a real character. I mean, you know, I think about him because I think this is the guy who changed my life. I don't think I would be playing poker if it weren't for Phil the Rabbi, because he kind of made the game at the Mayfair. And if it weren't for him, the game wouldn't have been very good and I wouldn't have been able to play it. Because that was, you know, that was in my really early days where I wasn't good enough to compete with the better players.
The Mayfair was located sort of in the shadow of Wall Street, you might say, which meant that it was an obvious place to attract gamblers interested in stocks or traders interested in poker. Eric Seidel was part of a group of players that had a foot in both worlds.
I think probably my wife had more confidence than I did. She was the one who at some point decided that we should make a go of Las Vegas. And she knew I wasn't happy working on Wall Street. And she said, well, let's go out to Vegas and try that for 5 years. So she, I think, probably had more faith in my game and my ability to win at that time than I did. And, you know, I was working on Wall Street, and then I was also flying out to play in poker games. And so it was a lot to try and do both. And it was kind of wearing me down. And the funny thing about Wall Street, we were living in New York. Now we had two kids, and it was, even though I was making a decent living, expenses in New York are so high that trying to, you know, pay for rent and two kids going to private school really became, you know, for me, you know, kind of a scary thing. Could I continue to do that? And I didn't really, I mean, I knew I could continue the, or I thought I could continue to make money on Wall Street, but I didn't, I wasn't making enough that I felt like, well, you know, now we have a nice cushion. And so the idea of moving to Las Vegas and cutting our expenses and trying a different life. And also just, I think that my wife Rula's feeling was that she didn't want to get in the way. She wanted me to be able to pursue my dreams, which, you know, at that time, I really did want to play poker. And I wanted to see, you know, how well I could do playing poker.
Steve Zolotow also played at the Mayfair, so he was able to watch this revolving door between gambling and Wall Street.
It's a two-way street. There are people who are in other professions and go to games, and there are people who are in game playing and go to other professions. You mentioned Jimmy Cain before was somebody who was a gambler who became a Wall Street guy. Probably the most successful of the Wall Street guys, more so even than Jimmy Cain, is a guy, Jeff Yass, who was a small stake poker player and went into options trading and started a company, Susquehanna, which is now probably the largest individual company trading options in the world. And, you know, he's head of that, and he's made what most people would consider many fortunes. Bobby Baldwin was another one who was a poker player, games player, who went into the casino business. And likewise, you had people who worked in Wall Street and decided they didn't like working in Wall Street. They turned around and took up poker or took up bridge or took up backgammon or something else. And they said, boy, this is a lot more fun than Wall Street. So you have both people going and coming.
Steve didn't mention Blair Hull in that clip, but Blair is a really great example. He was on the original blackjack team that pioneered the big player approach, and he was also profiled in the book, The New Market Wizards, by Jack Schwager.
Blackjack was a very objective game. You'd keep the count, you'd convert it into a true count, and you'd bet a proportional to the true count. I tried to do everything I could in the financial markets in a consistent, objective way. I came up with a strategy of stock options that started to trade. And I figured that if you could get the expected value of an option, if you could figure out the possibilities of where the stock would go, and then you could determine a probability that they would get there, and then you multiplied the outcome times the probabilities, you'd get what would be called the expected value. And if you took into account dividends and interest rates, you could get the true value of an option. And so I actually produced an option model, and started buying cheap options and selling expensive options. And that's, of course, that way of valuing options was published by two people, Fisher Black and Myron Scholes. It's called the Black-Scholes model. And so my model actually converges to the Black-Scholes model. Even though I still had a full-time job, I leased the seat and I'd go there at 6:30 in the morning and I'd trade from 6:30 to 8:30. I'd take BART, Bay Area Rapid Transit from San Francisco to Oakland, work from 9 to 12, jump on BART, go back and trade the close from 12 to 1:30, and then jump back on BART and go back to work at Kaiser Cement. And I did that for about 6 weeks. And then I said, I was so exhausted because then at the end of the day, I had to go prepare to trade the next day. That I told my boss at Kaiser Cement that if he had me in his long-term future, he should probably change his plans for me. I just said I'd like to leave at some point. I don't want to leave I want to finish my projects that I'm working on. But then I left Kaiser Cement and Gypsum and worked full-time as a market maker on the Pacific Stock Exchange. And at that time when I did that, I had about a $25,000 options bankroll, and I think I was down $2,000 at that point, but I made the leap of faith to say I could do it.
My favorite part of that story is that to that point, Blair was a net loser for his options career. Also, he had a monthly fee that was going to eat up a substantial part of his bankroll, and yet he took his shot. It ended up working out because in the late 90s, Blair sold his trading company to Goldman Sachs for more than $500 million. Blair's career was also very much about employing technology to get an edge. We didn't always have things like high-frequency trading. It took decades of evolution to get to where we're at today. But the role that computers have in markets is now so ubiquitous that we've had guests say, actually, I try to figure out what computers can't do, and then I focus there. This is Jason Strasser. He's the CIO of the options trading firm Caption Partners.
Very early on in options, I realized that the markets were normally efficient and there wasn't much edge to be had, but there were some unique situations where you could find edge. And if I had to summarize it without getting too much into the details, I always encourage people to think about what computers are good at and what, you know, trading firms that analyze lots of data are good at and what they're bad at. You know, if you ask a trading firm, what's the fair value on Apple's volatility tomorrow? You know, that's something that they'd be very good at pricing. You know, they have a lot of data on past moves on Apple. They can see how volatility is priced on the market, how volatility is priced on the NASDAQ, whatever. They can make a very, very, very clean market on how much Apple's going to move tomorrow on just a random day with no headlines. But if there's an upcoming event that's more one-off in nature, you know, all the data in the world is not going to help you with that. And so that's kind of how I feel where I focused early on in my career. What kinds of problems are there out there that lots of data won't help you with? And you need a human to analyze a one-off event. You know, an example is an election, right? You can have all the data in the world on all the past elections in any country, but every election, whether it's in the US or Brazil or Argentina or wherever, they have its own dynamics. And you have to analyze it on a one-off basis. You know, there's a little bit of information you can get from past data, but it's, yeah, you have to analyze it. And so I've largely focused my entire career on one-off upcoming events and really, really studying them and seeing if I can find mispriced options.
Jason was a poker player before he went to Wall Street. We've actually heard similar stories from other guests. Evan Tindall was a poker player when he was young, and now he's a value investor. Evan says that instead of looking for blind spots that a computer might have, he looks for blind spots that humans have. He looks for well-established cognitive biases and then buys companies that might be undervalued because people are hardwired to get it wrong.
I mean, when you buy a stock, you basically need like the whole investment community to be making an error. Because like at that moment, like say you're buying a stock that's worth the, you know, it's priced at $20 and you think it's worth 40, right? But you got to be the highest possible bid in, you know, in the country for that stock at a given time to actually buy a share of it, right? So implicitly, you need everyone else in the market to be making a mistake because it's, it's priced, you know, at a very undervalued level. And for all those people to be making a mistake, it needs to be something systematic, right? it needs to be like something that affects more than one brain, like in a systematic way. Otherwise, it would probably not, you know, create so many errors about a particular about one stock.
Evan has a small firm, but they've had really nice results, and he's also gotten some very public calls right. He says that his edge probably comes from his judgment. So I asked him whether that skill can be learned.
It's probably part learned, probably part innate, like kind of ability to take a step back and like just at least try to know about the biases, like take a step back, try to like rationally think about like, okay, well, what other information could I look for here to kind of like confirm what's going on? Like there's a little bit of skepticism you have to have with everything, I think. I think a lot of people could overcome these biases if they just were always willing to. I think like just one of the most important things is just like having like a natural curiosity, like kind of not being satisfied with like the first answer, if that makes sense. And the willingness to be patient until you can kind of figure out until you just have more confidence that you've figured out what's going on. But it's not easy. I do think there's some, some innate thing. I mean, I used to see it in poker actually, where, no matter how, like at MIT, for example, like there's a lot of smart people, but like there was just some that were kind of naturally, like the whole thing about poker of like really trying to like rationally figure out what's going on, like in this like game, was it just didn't suit. So it just didn't suit some people as much. Like it just wasn't. And it's not like a raw horsepower, like intelligence thing, obviously, because I mean, these are all MIT kids, but it was, yeah, I think part of it was just like some type of innate thing for sure. Some portion.
Perhaps the classic problem when you're doing this kind of thing is, how do you size your bets? Okay. And actually that's not a hard problem. The hard problem is, how do you size your bets if you're almost sure you'll win, except in an instance where you just completely misjudge the probabilities? This isn't a hypothetical. Last year, a few of us got involved in this Twitter merger arb trade. The idea was that we bought Twitter at like $35 and then hoped that eventually Elon Musk would pay us $54.20 per share. Keep in mind that over a number of months, he said he definitely did not want to do that, which meant that we were effectively betting against the world's richest man. So we were long a bet that people told us we were dumb to make, because what are the odds we're smart and he's dumb? And yet, we were almost sure we had the best of it. Almost sure. Unless, and this is a huge asterisk, we didn't understand it at all. So again, how much do you bet in that situation? Here's Chris DeMuth. He's one of the smart people that got involved in this thing, and he said he put on a big position.
It was by far the largest merger arb position I ever had. Might be the biggest one I'll ever have. One of my three biggest positions of any type. I thought it was terrific. And you could kind of describe it in two different ways. One is you could say, I thought there was a very high probability we would get either 54.20 that we were owed, or some sort of settlement that gave us a time and risk adjusted settlement that was equivalent, that would have been a very small deal cut, but you know, perhaps we could have split the difference on some of the risk and some of the time, given that I thought that the downside was pretty rough. I think that we were looking at a range, call it between $15 and $25 per share of realistic downside scenarios. And I think I was probably at the low end of that range. We thought it was more like 15. And by the end of the deal, it might have been more like 10. I mean, really bad. You'll lose a lot of money if you're wrong here. But when we looked at this judge, looked at her precedents, looked at the facts here, which we thought were more in favor of specific performance requiring the deal to get done, we thought the pretext that Elon had presented were less plausible than cases that had lost in the past. You could say 90 or 95%, 9 out of 10, 19 out of 20, somewhere in there that we win. But in some sense, I don't want to say I was certain that we were going to win, but I was certain that based on the information we had, the right decision was to side with Twitter. And this judge was giving every indication that she would make the right decision. I felt very comfortable with that. And then whatever losing scenario was left over was really something new that hadn't come to light yet. And that's always going to be there. So I could not invest in this, but I could invest in the next thing. And that too would have some chance that something that hadn't come to light yet would happen that would be adverse.
The Twitter trade ended up working out well in the end. And the real kicker is that conventional wisdom completely flipped after it happened. It went from, you're dumb to do this, to, of course it was obvious in hindsight. I think there's probably a lesson in there that might apply more broadly to markets, which is, you might be looking for things where the narrative is driven by noise and not fundamentals. In the case of this trade, it was all much easier because we had a ringer, someone whose entire job is to follow the Delaware court where the case was being heard. And so while the media chased the claims of Elon Musk like a cat frantically following a laser pointer, there was one account in a tiny corner of Twitter that just kept delivering the goods. This is Chance.
My big takeaway from all of this is that the media as a whole is absolutely terrible at reporting on legal proceedings. And it makes sense because if you're not a legal expert, and even if you are, you have to be incredibly careful about how you interpret arguments that are being made by advocates. And then you have to understand, you have to, first of all, not be taken in by the argument when you read one side's brief and then you read the other side's brief. You can't do this like flip-flopping back and forth. I don't think you should, as a legal commentator, just like dive entirely into one side or the other. But this case was so lopsided that it was a little bit awkward at times because the legal case was just very weak for Musk from the jump. And so that's one of the reasons why I think people to some degree thought, I must hate Elon Musk or something. Like, no, he just happened to have a particularly terrible legal position here. And so, but the media is so inept in a lot of ways at actually looking at legal filings and making sense of them before they become rulings. And then even looking at the rulings and seeing what did they mean. Just like a lot of it was sort of very procedural, where the media just didn't seem to have the knowledge about how the court system works to report reliably on what was going to happen or what had happened. Or, you know, like when we started getting into this late phase where there was like stuff coming out from under seal after the stay had been granted, it got so squirrely. Like people were reporting stuff as though it were news, you know, a week after the fact and interpreting it like it had just happened that day. And it was just so nuts.
We've also had a few episodes about people that short stocks for a living. This is because I really enjoy their antics. It's like, of course it's easier to just buy stocks and watch them go up, but that's what makes short selling so fun. And also, the idealized strategy would offer returns which are positive and uncorrelated to the rest of the market. So to do that, it really helps to short some names and get negative correlation. This is John Hempton. He has an amazing description of the difficult, maybe you could say nearly impossible, job of a short seller.
In Perth in West Australia, and also in Vancouver, there is a large industry doing fake gold stocks. The idea is that you peg a whole lot of land, you tell people that it's got gold, and you're not really mining for gold, you're really mining for money on the floor of the stock exchange. These people bring to mind Mark Twain's famous definition of a gold mine, which is a hole in the ground with a liar on top. Now, imagine you know for sure that one of these gold companies that claims to have 1 million ounces in the ground has no gold at all. You can actually know that for sure in certain ways. If there's gold in them, their hills, there's gold in the creek below the hill. If you hire a professional panner and you go and pan the creek below the hill and you don't find any gold, then you know for sure that there's no gold in the hill. And in fact, you don't even need to hire a professional panner. All you need to do is contact the local region, you know, country town librarian, and there'll always be history of the area, you know, that somebody's written, and the librarian would love to talk to you, and they'll give you a history of the gold panning in the area. There's always one. And if there's no history of successful gold panning in the area, then you know there's no gold in the hill. Okay, so now you know there's no gold in the hill. You have an edge. There's a stock out there that might be trading for $300 million, and it's worth nothing. It's an edge. The question is it an exploitable edge, and how do you exploit it without risk of ruin? Suppose you have done this and you decide, okay, now that I've got this edge, I'm going to short 5% of my, well, use the gambling term, my role, you know, my gambling role, or 5% of my portfolio in this stock. Most of the time, the stock's going to go to zero. And over 2 to 3 years, you'll add 5% to your portfolio. And if you can do that 4 or 5 times a year, you're Warren Buffett, right? Because, you know, index plus 15 is better than Warren Buffett. Sounds pretty good, except it doesn't work that way. And the reason it doesn't work that way is that the one thing you know about this guy is he's a liar. He's already lied and told you that he has 1 million ounces. And there's a fairly good chance that he's going to lie and tell you he has 10 million ounces. You know, finding 1 million ounces of gold is hard. Finding 10 million ounces of gold is even harder. Lying about 1 million ounces isn't that hard, and lying about 10 million ounces is no harder than lying about one. Now, if the market believes him, this stock that you've decided to short 5% of your wealth in, or 5% of your role in if you wish to, you know, be a gambler, is going to go up tenfold. And so instead of being 5% short, you're now 50% short. Except you got a problem, which is your capital's gone from, you know, 100 to 55 because you've just lost 45% of your bankroll. And so you're now over 90% short. And if you're 90% short a single name, your good friends at Robinhood or Interactive Brokers, or in our case, Morgan Stanley and JP Morgan, are going to put you out of business. And they're going to put you out of business on a stock on which you're right. And so what you have is an edge, but it's an edge that's exceptionally dangerous to exploit.
It's kind of crazy to think about all of the forces aligned against short sellers. It's not just company management, which, as Hempton points out, can be formidable opponents. It's that the whole world wants stocks to go up. Some people consider short selling to be immoral because you're rooting for failure. I think that's preposterous, since pretty much every company is trying to put someone else out of business. But then it's also very likely you'll end up against the stock's touts and captured sell-side analysts. This is Mark Cahotas.
My former partner, Monty, and I were short this company called Avid, which made at the time post-production equipment. And the big thing was we knew and researched and found out that they were financing all these purchases of this equipment themselves through a captive finance arm, and their sales and their business was shady. And it was a real growth company. And they had this captive arm called Avid Financial Services. And I used to get on their conference calls, and this is when they allowed me to get on conference calls. And whatever they would talk about, I'd always ask a question about Avid Financial Services. And Kurt Raleigh would say, you know, Mark, we have a great quarter. You know, it's not our fault. You're short the stock and losing your ass. There is no such thing as Avid Financial Services. And I don't know about others on the call, but I'm sick and tired of hearing about Avid Financial Services. Okay. Right. This was like on the September quarter. So I said to mine, I said, fuck this Kurt Raleigh, you know, fuck him, you know, trying to show me up on the call. So we go to God knows where. They're having some conference of post-production editors because this technology is new. So we go and we have these cards printed up, M&M Video Services, post-production, commercials, advertising. You know, we had to do something to get in. So we get in this thing and there's all these production guys, but we're researching this thing deeply, so I know all the lingo, and Avid is there. And I said, you know, my partner Monty, and Monty has long hair and he has a long beard. I said, he's a bit of a hippie and I'm dressed like shit. And I said, I don't know if we have $114,000 to buy the Avid 1, the Avid 6, and the Avid 3 to do it. Is there any way we can finance this? And the guy said, yeah, we have something called Avid Financial Services. I said, you do? They said, yeah. I said, can I get an application? They said, yeah, here's one. And I said, can I have the business cards of the rep of Avid Financial Services so we can call them? They said, yeah, here's one. I said, I'm a little spacey. can I have 10 of these cards? And he goes, sure, take as many as you want. I said, wonderful. So we hit the fucking jackpot with this, right? I mean, Monty and I go out and then we have beers and do whatever. And I say, we're going to have some fun with this. So the main bull on the stock is this guy named Haney Nada. And he's now some VC guy or private equity guy or whatever he is. So we call up Haney and say, Haney, it's kind of over. He goes, what do you mean? What do you mean? I said, we have proof, hard proof that Avid Financial Services exists. This is before camera phones, by the way, right? This is before, you know, you can just take a picture of the card and email it to somebody. So we either go and to the copier and copy it and fax it to them or, you know, this, that, and the other. There's no scans back in the day here. No phone pictures. We send it to them. Say, call us back, call us back. He calls us back. He goes, you guys are really good. He goes, you guys are pros. We said, aren't we? We're pretty good, aren't we, Haney? He goes, where did you have this stuff printed up? I said, you have got to be kidding me. I said, you think we had this printed up? Do you think we had these printed up to send it to you? He goes, yeah, Avid Financial Services doesn't exist. I said, you dumbass motherfucker. We're not lying. This is the truth. So we go to Herb Greenberg, who at the time is writing for the San Francisco Chronicle, and we send him stuff. And he says, proof of Avid Financial Services, this, that, and the other. The stock goes like 44 to 37, right? And it's December like 16th or 17th. And Haney calls me, and we're having our Christmas party in a restaurant. I'll never forget it. And he goes, you're right. Avid Financial Services does exist. He goes, I was wrong. I believe you. So, okay. I said, so are you downgrading the stock to sell tomorrow? He says, no, I can't do it. I said, why? He says, because all the institutions are voting for the best analyst. And if I downgrade the stock to a sell tomorrow, Fidelity won't vote for me. Putnam won't vote for me. T. Rowe won't vote for me. All these guys will hold the stock. So he was keeping his recommendation as a strong buy because he didn't want to disrupt the stock at the end of the year because he wanted their vote. So this is like Thursday, like December 17th. So like on that next Tuesday or Wednesday, this Avid like pre-releases and they like shit all over themselves. They say the quarter's bad, restating earnings, suspending all guidance, Kurt Raleigh to resign, you know, bad debt charge of Avid Financial Services, the whole fucking deal. And the stock literally, I mean, see, this is the days when things would get killed. The stock literally was like 37 to like 8. And we were like hooting and hollering and the whole thing. And Haney Nada then calls up and it was like someone just lynched his dog in a tree. He goes, I don't know what to say. I am professionally embarrassed. I can't believe they pre-released. I said, you dumb fuck. I said, we gave this to you. Gave this to you. And you said, we made this shit up. I said, I don't make anything up. You dumb fuck. But, you know, that's the story of Avid and that's the story of the gotcha. But, you know, Haney Nada is probably worth $300 million and whatever private equity dig he's running. And everyone thinks he's smart, but he's probably one of the worst sell side analysts I've ever run across.
To get back to the point that John Hempton made earlier, sometimes these trades can really go against you. And so every short seller seems to have some method or strategy to avoid getting their head taken off. Mark Cahotas says he doesn't want to climb into a tree and try to wrestle a jaguar.
This can't be yogurt, symbol TCBY, which was a frozen yogurt franchise that was brought public by a bucket shop in Chicago called Chicago Corp. I knew it was a fad. The product tasted like shit, but they were growing like crazy. And McDonald's was getting in the yogurt business, serving frozen yogurt at their stores. And I thought this thing was dead because McDonald's was getting in the business. And I think it went up about 5 times and we lost our ass on it. before the thing blew up. And it would have made a whole lot more sense for them to have negative comp pricing pressure in the first day where the stock got cut in half, from where it got cut in half to where the thing sold out down 96% from there. It would have been a lot easier of a fight. So I said, I'm going to learn my lesson there. And I almost learned my lesson there, except I ran into something called iOmega, which made something called a zip drive, which is completely obsoleted. They're completely out of business. But at the time, it was the first thing with removable portable storage. And after the stock was already up 20 times, we decided to get involved. And then it went up another, I think, 10 times from there. And we didn't almost go out of business because we weren't that big in it, but it cost us a year. One of those years, we had a really bad year, and it was all because of iOmega. Now, we cut our position way, 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 way back, because once it goes up blank times against you, who's to say it ever stopped? But I said to myself, Jaguar in the tree, Jaguar in the tree. The Jaguar knocked me out of the tree. The Jaguar broke my back, but I'm not paralyzed and I'm still alive. So when iOmega finally blew up, the stock went from like 60 to 28, and we shorted the shit out of it at 28. And then it went from 28 to 10, and then we shorted the shit out of it at 10 on top of it. And then it went from 10 to 5, and then we shorted the shit out of it at 5. Then it went from 5 to 12, and we said, uh-oh, did we get too greedy and not cover it? We said, no, these guys are fucked. Then it went from 12 to like 1. So we ended up doing really well in it, but it was only after they completely and utterly blew up. And blew up meant DVD, readable, writable, thumb drive, and things like that, which obsoleted what they did.
We don't have nits on this show. Almost every guest is either by their nature pretty comfortable with gambling, or they've built up a tolerance. But Bill Perkins is what you might call the prototypical gambler. It's not just that he's fine with winning and losing, even though he is. It's that he explicitly describes his job as being paid to take risk. As a natural gas trader, he's always one black swan weather event away from getting wrecked.
We say, okay, given normal weather, what's the S&D? Let's say the S&D is very loose and you want to be short and prices are too high, etc. In a winter, that doesn't really matter if it's very cold, right? You're gonna get hurt. Well, we had a winter where it was a winter for the record books, or a month for the record books, and it was continual. And we also had a liquidity crisis with people needing to get out, and so it almost destroyed me. If you're gonna be a boxer, you better like getting punched to a certain extent. You better be okay with getting punched. You need to be okay with even getting knocked down. If not, every time you get punched and you're like, what the fuck? Why am I doing this? Like, what's going on? Like, you know, like, this is not for you. And so if I have a 1 in 71 year winner, or if I have this, 1 in whatever event happen, you know, it's just part of the job. I get paid to get punched in the face and deal with it and chop wood out of it. The only thing that disturbed me is that, you know, I had different pieces of advice coming in, like, oh, you should just shut down the fund and trade your own money. You're not going to be able to claw out of the hurdle, right? The high watermark, or you know, you have all these expenses and employees you got to cover. Is like, I was really worried more about the employees than anything else. I was not worried about the money I lost or the money, whatever. I was worried about, if I shut down, will the other employees be able to get jobs? But as far as like my confidence in trading, no, not one bit, not one iota.
Bill's comments offer a good chance to talk about what we can crudely call luck. Just because you have an edge does not mean you'll always have a smooth ride. And it's not just the fact that volatility can be very hard on your capital. It's that it can also have damaging effects on your psyche. Here's Richard Munchkin again. When he became a card counter, he played 150 hours and lost. It was enough for him to give up for a while, even though he eventually got back into advantage play.
You know, you have imposter syndrome. I must be doing something. I must not be playing correctly. I'm fooling myself because I must not be doing this right, or I couldn't lose for this long. Number two, I'm letting down my teammates is a huge part of it. And I'm letting down the investor. He's, you know, I'm losing all this money that belongs to Alan. You know, I felt horrible about that. So it was just a combination of all those things. And I kept thinking, if this really works, how many hours is, you know, we didn't have the ability to run computer simulations back then. So, yeah, I was like, if this really works, how long is it supposed to take? Aren't I supposed to win eventually? You know?
You can also imagine the flip side of this coin. When you're losing, you feel like you can't win. When you're winning, you feel like you can't lose. Burt Black was the founder of the first betting exchange, Betfair, and he says that running well might have altered the course of his entire life.
I was interested from a betting perspective from fairly early on. I guess I was introduced to it by my uncle, who was an inveterate gambler and always in the bookies. I think that I probably got thrown out of university, at least in part, because I spent too much time at the bookies. I sort of look back on my life and I wonder if maybe if I hadn't been lucky in some of my early gambling escapades, that maybe my whole life would have been different. I think the first time I put money in a fruit machine, I won the jackpot. I think the first time I put a Yankee on the horses, I think three of them came up and I won a stack of money. So I sort of think maybe those things kind of colored my view of it all. And maybe if I hadn't had any luck in the early days, maybe my whole life would have panned out differently.
So what's the remedy when the basic act of going to work every day will produce results that mess with your brain? We heard from Ray Marino in part one. He's the former gambler that works for a sports book now.
Try never to get too high and never to get too low. Like, you know, as long as you're doing the right things to be successful, don't let the bad times bother you so much, and don't get too cocky when things are going good, you know, because things are never as good as they seem and things are never as bad as they seem, you know. So just to stay a little more even keeled and just know that this, you know, this is all hard work. You know, you have people constantly that, it's so exciting what you do. It's got to be great to just be able to just gamble for a living. And I don't think they have any idea how much work it is. So it's something that you can't do, I don't think, without a true passion for it, because you have to enjoy it. Because I certainly work harder doing this than I ever would have worked at any other job, you know, just normal 9-to-5. But at the end of the day, it doesn't feel like work because it's what I enjoy doing.
All of these comments that sound like they should be on a accessories poster for gamblers are no doubt true, because they come from practitioners who have found them useful in their own lives. And also, that's all fine to say until you get your ass completely handed to you, and in a way that nobody expected and that no one could expect. So now we'll turn our attention back to long-term capital management. In case you're not familiar with the story, I'm going to give the absolute Cliff's Notes so you can understand it in relation to this episode. LTCM was a hedge fund in the 90s that specialized in arbitrage trades, which had very small edges and also very low volatility. So they would find two bonds that were very, very similar, but that traded at a spread. So they'd go long the cheap bond and short the expensive one, and eventually when prices converged, they'd make a return. But the return for these things was very small. Small enough that no one would really invest in a hedge fund that did just that trade, so they would add leverage and multiply the return. This actually worked really well for years. But then in August of 98, Russia defaulted on some of its debt, and that was like the first spark in a chain reaction. The problem for LTCM was that the crisis started with a market-wide flight to quality, but eventually it was entirely focused on the once high-flying hedge fund. It's like if you've ever watched your portfolio and every day some names go up and some names go down. Now imagine that every investor that owns what you own only wants out, and everything goes down all at once for a month straight. Also, because LTCM had used so much leverage in their trades, their counterparties were like everyone. This is Eric Rosenfeld again. Eric was one of the founding partners of LTCM.
We thought if we go under, for sure, Bankers Trust and Lehman are going under, and maybe it'll bleed through to Merrill Lynch. And then who knows, maybe it could go to Goldman and Citi I mean, it would just be this domino effect where we could be the original trigger. We saw it happening. We were telling lots of people that this was going to happen and how to prevent it, but we were, you know, totally unsuccessful, including the Federal Reserve. That's why they were having this meeting.
This is a classic example of success which sows the seeds of its own downfall. Their returns were good enough that they attracted imitators, and so over time, their edge got smaller and smaller. Keep in mind, they were aware this was happening. In fact, at the end of 97, they went to their investors and said, look, we can't actually deploy all of the capital. You're going to have to take some back.
We saw that opportunities were much less, you know, at the end of 1997 than they were at any time kind of in Solomon or in LTCM. The opportunity set was much lower. And in fact, we went out to investors and we told them that. We said, you know, rather than earning sort of 40 and 50% returns, we think we're going to earn, you know, around 15% returns in 1998. And we asked them to take a forced dividend. And of course, they all came back to us. No one wanted to take a dividend. They all asked if they could invest more.
I'm going to use a word that I've used to describe the other guests and say that LTCM were pioneers. Okay, because what are the two things they're most well known for? Their use of models and the fact that PhDs had a lot of influence in the fund. But look at Wall Street today. The models have only become more complicated and more widespread. And the place is also thick with PhDs. If anything, we can say that LTCM was ahead of its time. So the criticisms which focus on their overuse of leverage, those are probably fair. But the anti-elitist stuff about how the firm was run by eggheads with no real-world experience, that's just like complete bullshit. Also, the part of the LTCM story that no one remembers is that ultimately they had positive returns over the life of the fund, helped in no small part because when they saw their trades get crowded, they forced investors to take money back.
The average investor had a 19% internal rate of return, including the losses. Only 10 investors lost money, and only 5 investors lost more than, I think, like $5 million.
Of course, there are formulas to manage risk. But those formulas also imply that the risks you're taking are somewhat well understood. And I think if you go back and listen to the episodes, you'll hear time and time again that the guests kind of came up with their own risk management formulas. I mean, let's take the easy example. Blackjack is a game where all of the probabilities are known. If there's ever a time when you should really know your edge, it's 21. There's also the beautiful math of the card counting systems, which tell you how every rule change affects the edge. And then there's the Kelly criterion, which details the optimal amount to bet to grow your bankroll. So what could even go wrong? Well, it turns out that card counters very often underperform their expected results. And if they bet full Kelly, they go for a very wild ride. So they think, hey, maybe I'll only bet half Kelly, right? So it's this thing that starts out with elegant math and ends with a wild-ass guess. And when you go from the tables in Las Vegas to a hedge fund in Connecticut, the process might improve in degree, but it doesn't improve in kind. When LTCM failed and the partner started a new fund, they just said, hey, what if we use a little less leverage this time? And then try to guess if, when they took this idea to the investors, if the investors agreed that Goldilocks had found exactly the right amount of risk this time.
I remember calling on one former LTCM investor. This guy is, you know, a mega Brazilian billionaire. And he was kind of running a family office with his son. And I went to see them, you know, a few weeks before we closed the new fund. And I told them sort of the tale of woe of LTCM and what had happened and what we were going to do in the new fund to prevent this from happening again. And about three quarters of the way through the presentation, the son had to leave to go take care of something. And I just stood with the, you know, finished the story with the father. And when I was done, I said, you know, can you give me a little bit of feedback? Would you be willing to invest in our new fund? You liked the first one, and now we've made some changes. And he said, there's no way I'm investing with you guys. You're way too risky for me. I'd be out of my mind. I said, okay, you know, I hear what you're saying. You know, thank you for your time. So I went to leave, and at the elevator, I saw the son. I said, you know, I just finished up with your father, but I'd be curious, you know, just if you could give me a little feedback, would you be interested in investing in the new fund? And the son looked at me and said, you know, you've been so beaten up. I don't see you taking any risks again. So there's no way I'm going to invest with you because you're not really going to lever up the positions at all. So yeah, it was kind of that story of, you know, everybody had an excuse as to why not to invest with us. So it was pretty tough going early on.
There are a few important parts of the frontier metaphor that I hope I've gotten across. First, the frontier is for pioneers, people willing to strike out and see what exists in the part of the world where things aren't well known and where things aren't settled. These pioneers are people who, by their very nature, don't mind learning a few lessons the hard way. This unsettledness is the source of all of the opportunity and also all of the danger. And then lastly is that the frontier is not stationary. It is always drifting. So anyone who finds an edge today has some time before other boundary pushers, who are also obsessive, discover that same thing. I want to wrap up by hearing what happens when the choices these people make come into contact with the rest of their lives. We heard from Joe in part one. He's the card counter that ran his bankroll up to $1 million because he obsessively went after casinos.
When I first got into card counting, I was like so obsessed with it and, you know, just like practicing it all the time. And I wanted to play like above anything else, you know, at that point, like above relationships and, you know, things like that. So I was just ready because at the time when I started, I was single. Like I was just like, hey, I'm just going to hit the road and just do this thing I'm really passionate about and see where it goes. And so, you know, I did that for, you know, the good first year, played a ton of hours. And then, you know, it was so cool and such a great ride. But at the same time, like towards the end, I was starting to get like really lonely. You know, I had made a decent amount of money. At that point, I was sort of weighing like, how much am I sacrificing here? Like, how much am I sacrificing? Like, how much more do I need to feel like happy or safe and secure? And how much am I just like, feel like I'm just spinning my wheels, just trying to like build up this nest egg? Like, for what? Professional gambling is so great in so many ways because like you have your freedom of schedule. You know, it's a fun, enjoyable thing to do. You know, it can be exciting. But then at the same time, it's like you're not producing anything. You're not making people happy. Like you don't have customers that you're trying to like, you know, have them satisfied. Like usually everyone just hates you in the casino. Like the managers are usually annoyed with you and the dealers are really annoyed with you and the players, they don't like you. Yeah. After a while, I started to get a little bit burnt out on just sort of doing the same thing over and over again, just moving chips back and forth, especially all the driving and all the being backed off and some of the unpleasant interactions over and over again. You know, that can really wear on you. So then the next couple of years after that, you know, I like really slowed down some. And now I'm kind of at the point where I'm still doing like a decent amount of AP stuff, but I also have another venture I'm doing that's, you know, totally unrelated just because I wanted to just like know what it was like to create something with my own hands, sort of just have a physical product and have people like receive it and like it and sort of see where that goes.
In one of the early episodes, we met a card counter that goes by Sassy Red. She has an incredibly unique story because she became an Advantage player in her 50s.
If I want to go and spend a month with my 82-year-old dad in a different state, I can. If I want to go spend 2 weeks on the beach with my grandbabies, I can. It's also taught me to look for, how do I put this? Positive EV is the term we use in other areas in my life. You know, how to be efficient, how to not waste time. I also am a drama queen and I get to kind of play my roles and, you know, theater was something that never panned out for me past school. And so I get to indulge that side of me a little bit and that's been fun. I got to reinvent myself in my 50s. I mean, that's pretty amazing. I've lived this whole well, as long as I've been alive, you know, five and a half decades, and there's always possibilities. I think most people who get to my stage of life look back and feel that way to some degree, but they've been spectacularly different, each of these stages in my life. And, you know, raising a family, touring with a band, getting a master's degree in the therapy field, then traveling, it's you never know when you're going to get to reinvent your life and what will come along. And I think I'm better able to seize the day, to carpe diem doing this, than I have been in the past.
This is Ho Yi again. He said that a feeling of responsibility to his family took him as far as law school at Yale, but he left that world to become an Advantage player, living on the road, sometimes sleeping in his car as he went after casinos.
But from my perspective, it was more like, you know, I've lived my whole life in terms of this idea of filial piety, and just now I'm starting to be able to do what I want in life, and I'm still, you know, making a good living at it. And, you know, everything leading up to this, like, I had growing up, I had ideas about what I really wanted to do. I was a pretty successful competitive fighter for a while. I thought about wanting to do that. I thought about wanting to be an actor. I got some callbacks for some commercials, but, you know, those were the sort of dreams that my family would always shoot down because they were very insistive that I had a certain path that I needed to be on. And, you know, to deviate from that path would be to dishonor them and sort of make it so that I couldn't fulfill my obligations as a son. So, you know, when I was on the road living this vagabond lifestyle, completely removed from what I had ostensibly prepared my whole life for, it was just more of a feeling of freedom for me.
Risk of Ruin is written and produced by me. I want to thank all of the guests for telling their stories. I appreciate them both as the producer of this show and also as someone who has listened to every clip at least 20 times. I'm going to post a link in the show notes so you can find the show on all the platforms.